So among other things this morning, we need to think about the yeast of the Pharisees and the disciples who received their sight right at the end there. But if you put it all together, it really is about traveling with Jesus and seeing things as he sees things. And seeing ourselves as well. So, traveling. First of all, we need our map. Yes, right. The trouble with the country of Israel is that it's long this way, and our screens are this way, so it doesn't work very well. So I'm sorry, it's a bit small, and that's why I brought the pointer, because you probably won't be able to read the names. But there's the Sea of Galilee, Dead Sea, if you remember, is down about here, about the fire exit. And Galilee is up in the north, and we have the Sea of Galilee, where all this is taking place. And we come in about this area here, at the Decapolis, which is the wilderness area where Jesus feeds the 4,000. And then he crosses in the boat to somewhere around here, we think, Dalmanutha. There, we think Dalmanutha is there, but scholars aren't very sure exactly where it is. And that's the more populous area, and that's where the chief priests, Pharisees come to speak to Jesus and question him and ask for a sign. And then after he declares no sign will be given, the disciples get in the boat again and they cross to the north, to Bethsaida, where the blind man receives his sight. And then after that, they're heading north, way up north, to Caesarea Philippi, and it's on the road as they travel, just the disciples together, that Peter makes his well-known declaration of who Jesus is. Okay, let's think about where we are as well, not only geographically, but where we are in Mark's Gospel. And if you remember, we set out at the beginning, we were only going to take the first eight chapters, and we finish off this morning at verse 30. But the first bit, first line there is preaching the kingdom. And the kingdom is a fairly big theme in Mark's Gospel. And if you remember, the kingdom isn't just the church, it's beyond the church. And it's not just now, it's the future promise as well. And the message is to a wider audience. And then as Jesus heads north with just his disciples and a smaller group, you have what some scholars have called the retirement ministry, where Jesus is spending a little more time with his disciples and focusing on them and teaching them the cost of being a disciple. And then after that, we have the rest of Mark's Gospel is the final week in Jerusalem, and Mark gives us a lot of detail about that. Okay, so why do we need that outline? What's the importance of it? Well, it helps our own understanding as we go through Mark's Gospel. It helps us put things in place, helps us understand. And I don't know about you, but when you've got things set out a bit like that, then it's easier to remember. It's also helpful when we want to explain to others. I've been speaking off and on to a lad who's been interested, and we talked back and forth a wee bit about Dawkins and New Atheism, and I've pointed him in the direction of folk like Alistair McGrath and John Lennox, who are very good modern apologists and able to answer Dawkins, and he's been looking at that, and then he said to me, well, I really ought to read the Bible. And I said, yeah, that's a good idea. And okay, this is somebody, like many people, who have never read the Bible before in our society. They've never read the Bible. So if somebody says that to you, what do you tell them? Where do you start? And I said to him, well, it's a wee bit like Star Wars. He was going to start Genesis and work his way through. And I said, well, a bit like Star Wars, you probably want to start film four, which is the New Testament. That Mark's Gospel, it's shorter and more succinct, it's probably the best place to start. And to have some idea of that and give somebody some direction, that's probably the best way to go. Read the Gospels first, the New Testament, and then work your way back into the Old Testament. So it's important to have a grasp of where Mark is going in his gospel so we can explain it to others, and it helps our own understanding. Okay, so let's go on to look at our passage, and I've split it up into five sections, right, okay. So just short sections. First of all, the feeding of the 4,000, and then the yeast of the Pharisees at Dalmanutha, and then we have the pessimism of the disciples as they cross the lake and they've only got one loaf between them. And then we've got the healing of the blind man at Bethsaida, a slightly peculiar, in the best sense of the word, miracle. And then as we come to Peter's confession of Christ, we'll do that around the communion table. So hope you're all able to stay with us this morning. If you have to rush away, then do so during the last hymn, because we'll go straight in to the communion together and think together about Peter's confession of Christ at that point. So first of all then, the feeding of the 4,000. There we go. So we've already had the feeding of the 5,000 in Mark 6 and verse 30 and following. So is this just a mistake? Is it just a repetition? What's going on here? Well, it's not a repetition for at least two reasons. First of all, there's a number of important differences between the two accounts, and Jesus himself in our passage points them out. There's a number fed. There's 4,000 versus 5,000. There's the initial means. There's seven loaves and a few fish versus five loaves and two fish. And there's the number of baskets left over. Here there's seven baskets left over. In the previous miracle, there was 12 baskets left over. Now, I don't know about you, but over the years, when you come across the feeding of the 4,000, you think, Jesus didn't actually do so well there, did he? Because he started with seven fish instead of five. And he only got seven baskets left over instead of 12. So, and there was more fish as well. So really, it wasn't quite as good as the last one. But actually, if you look at the Greek word that's used for baskets in both miracles, it's translated into English basket in both miracles, but in the Greek, it's different. In the first feeding of the 5,000, it's like a basket, okay? In the feeding of the 4,000, it might be better hamper, okay? Because it's the same word that is used when Paul in Acts 9 is lowered from the wall in Damascus. He's lowered in a basket. That wasn't a little thing, okay? That was a hamper. Or maybe it was one of these baskets that they used to put stones in. I don't know if you've seen pictures of stones being carried in big baskets. These were big baskets, okay? They were seven baskets, but they were big ones. This is you're not being shortchanged with this miracle. Then there's a second reason for this being similar, but a separate account in Mark's story. It's to illustrate the consistent helplessness and pessimism of the disciples. Verse 4, they say, we're in a remote place. They'd already seen the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000, but they cannot look beyond themselves. They cannot raise their thoughts to realize, once again, who they are with. How often does the Lord despair at our lack of faith? You know, we tend to blame the disciples as being a bit slow, but just think through our own lives. Think how we get on. How often does the Lord despair at our pessimism, our lack of faith, and our lack of trust? Secondly, we've got the yeast of the Pharisees, verses 10 to 15. And this is kind of in two sections, because it's the Pharisees coming and asking for a sign, and then the disciples get in the boat and they have their own warning about the yeast of the Pharisees. In the parallel passage in Matthew 16, we read that the Sadducees came too, as well as the Pharisees. So that's probably the guys in brown are the Sadducees, okay? Just in case you were wondering. Now, let's remind ourselves again where we are. We had the Decapolis, the crowds were gathered in that wilderness area. They crossed over to Dalmanutha on the southwest shores, and that was a bit more crowded, so then it was more accessible for the Pharisees. So they take the easy road and they turn up where it's a bit easier to see Jesus. And they want a sign. Perhaps they don't believe the accounts of what Jesus has done. Perhaps they want a repetition of what Moses or Elijah had done. And probably if Jesus performed some miracle in front of them, did something like Elijah, then they would blame it on Beelzebub. Or perhaps they hoped that Jesus would try something and fail and then be discredited. A bit like our Prime Minister calling an election and getting it not quite right. In any case, it was insulting and challenging behavior. If they genuinely wanted to know, they would have followed Jesus as part of the crowd in humility and genuinely seeking God. So Jesus sighs deeply. He's frustrated. He's unable to help them in their own narrow-mindedness and unwillingness to believe. He's already provided abundant proof in himself, being with him, and in the miracles that he's already performed. So Mark's brief account here tells us that Jesus would give them no more sign. In the parallel account in Matthew, they are offered only the sign of Jonah. And that is, Jonah was 3 days in the fish, Jesus was 3 days in the grave, and then he rose again. What more could they possibly need than the resurrection? So Jesus leaves them. He crosses the Sea of Galilee again with his disciples in a boat, and this time to the northeast shore, to Bethsaida. And as they travel in the boat, Jesus continues to teach the disciples, and he warns them of the yeast, of the Pharisees, and of Herod. Now, for any of you who have a bread maker, then yeast is a good thing. The bread doesn't turn out awfully well if you forget to put it in, and I can tell you that from experience. But it often has yeast often has bad associations in the Bible. In Leviticus 2 and 11, we read that the grain of the bread offering had to be without yeast. It had to be pure. And in 1 Corinthians 5, Paul tells us to get rid of the old yeast of boasting, get rid of the old yeast that would spoil the fellowship. But who is Jesus warning the disciples about here? Because Matthew in his gospel mentions the Sadducees, and Mark quotes Jesus talking of the Herodians. Now, that's not necessarily inconsistent, because these two groups, the Sadducees and the Herodians, are pretty closely linked. The high priests belong to the Sadducees group, and the high priests were dependent on Herod's family, the ruling family of the time. Remember the four brothers that we talked about a few weeks ago. So it's not necessarily inconsistent. These are similar groups. And the Sadducees, if you remember, were the religious party who did not believe in the resurrection of the dead. They believed in the here and now, but not the future resurrection. And for any of you that can't remember what the Sadducees believed, then you know the old saying, yeah? Yeah, they didn't believe in heaven, so they were Sadducee. Okay. Right. So Jesus is talking about these three parties here with different characteristics. We know from other places, these characteristics we get from other places in the New Testament. The Pharisees were the traditionalists. Mark 7 and 4, we don't have time to look it up, but Mark 7 and 4 tells us about the ceremonial washing of hands that they indulged in, and not only hands, but cups and kettles and so on. Okay, it's good to wash your hands and the cups and kettles and so on, but this was done in a ceremonial way as well. So they made a big carry-on over it. And they did a whole lot of other things as well that were over and above what the Old Testament taught was necessary. They were traditionalists. Then we have the Herodians. And that's, if you like, the secularists, secularism they believed in. Okay, and if you remember last time, a couple of times ago in Mark's Gospel, we looked at the death of John the Baptist. And of course, it was a wild, drunken party that led to the beheading of John the Baptist. That was the Herodians. And then we have the Sadducees, who are the skeptics. Later on in Mark, we read this, that they come to Jesus with a silly story of the seven brothers, six of whom married the first brother's widow. As each brother died, then the next brother married the widow. And then whose wife would she be when they got to heaven? And they thought that disproved the fact that there could be a heaven. And then in Acts 23, we learn that as well as not believing in heaven, they didn't believe in angels or in spirits either. So Jesus is warning the disciples. He's using the opportunity as they cross the lake in the boat. He's using that opportunity to teach them and to warn them and us against these things, because these are traps that we can all fall into. We can all be guilty of seeking signs like the Pharisees were, looking for the miraculous when we already have a risen Savior. We already have the miracle of new birth, and we already have lives being transformed in front of us, if that wasn't miracle enough. Now, there's nothing wrong with miracles, but we don't need to go looking for them. They're here. They're all around us. They're in this fellowship of believers. And then we have the traditionalism. Now, we might think we're doing all right there. We've got a nice modern church building, not like some of the other more traditional churches. We're an independent church, and yet we debate about minor things and we struggle to move on. Minor changes we're not sure about. And we say, oh, hold on, maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe we should just do it this way. There's good reasons for still doing it this way. We should just carry on as we're doing, and we don't move on. We're stuck in our ways. We have a new minister starting in August, Peter Dale. And it is likely things might move on a little. Are we ready? Are we going to go along with him? Are we ready to talk together about the way we do things and maybe move on a little? Are we traveling with Jesus? Are we ready for some different scenery, from different things? Or are we stuck in our ways? And then we have secularism, the Herodians. Now, for most of us, I hope, drunken parties is not a big issue. But we live in a secular society. The god of money, of possessions, of position are all important. I think I've said this once here before, but we ran a Bible study group for teenagers for a short while when we were in Glasgow before we came to Shetland. It was in one of the slightly better areas of the south side of Glasgow, and going to church was the thing to do among some of these folk. One of the mothers, who was a church member, told us her son could no longer come to the Bible study that we were holding for them on a Sunday evening, because he got more important things to do. He had homework to do. He had to get the right grades. He had to get a good career. He had to get a good start in life. She thought that was more important than her son's eternal destiny. It's very easy for us to get sucked into the values of this world. We need to be careful. Jesus is warning us about these things. we're in great danger of living for this life and not the next. And then finally, the Sadducees talking about skepticism, or worse, cynicism. I think we all know what that can be. It's very easy to get caught up in that sort of talk and to become cynical about the things that are going on around us. Is it jealousy that dictates we always want to put down other people, and in doing so bring down the thoughts of those around us that are listening to us? May the Lord preserve us and our fellowship from such things. In this sort of fellowship, it's so easy for a small amount of these things to spread, the yeast of the Pharisees. As Paul reminds us, it's a small amount of boasting in that instance that works through the whole dough, that affects the whole fellowship with these things. Jesus warns the disciples against them, and he's warning us this morning. Thirdly then, and more briefly, we have the pessimism of the disciples in verses 16 to 21. Now, we're going to talk about pessimism of the disciples, but I don't know, I think they're pretty optimistic if they're all going to get in that boat. But maybe they took another one as well. Or maybe on the day it was actually a bigger boat. But anyway, this conversation took place in the boat as they crossed to Bethsaida. And the disciples are busy discussing the fact that they only brought one loaf, and it wasn't much between 13 men. And Jesus uses the opportunity to teach them about the yeast of the Pharisees and of Herod, but they miss the point completely. They're too taken up with their own needs. They cannot see beyond their own worries, and indeed their own stomachs. They cannot see the spiritual lesson that Jesus is trying to teach them. Jesus is warning them about being infected by the characteristics of his enemies, but now he has to correct another problem, their pessimism, their inability to see beyond themselves. They'd seen the miracle of the feeding of 5,000 and then of 4,000, and still they couldn't see beyond that one loaf. They couldn't understand who they were with. But again, we should not be quick to blame them. How often are we pessimistic? How often do we not see things the way Jesus wants us to see them? When we look around our world and see what's going on, we need to be aware that there's a God in control. When we look at our own lives going forward through the next day or the next week, we have Jesus with us, God's Spirit within us to help us. We need to see these things as Jesus sees them, as opportunities, not necessarily as things to make us pessimistic or sad or want to give up. Jesus' words from verse 17 to 21 are gentle words. They're both reproachful, but designed to take them out beyond themselves in their pessimism. He reminds them they need not worry about bread. They should have used their heads to see what was Jesus was saying. They should have used their hearts as well. Their eyes could not see and their ears could not hear because they couldn't get beyond themselves. And the memory of the events of the feeding of the 5,000, the 4,000, it had already gone as well. They needed to remember what Jesus had done for them already and continually apply that to their lives. And in the same way, we need to keep reminding ourselves and to put the truth of the gospel and to remember the Savior that we have beside us as we look at each day and each week in our lives. This teaching is so relevant to all of us. Again, we have a new minister coming. Is he going to find us ready to receive spiritual truth? Are our eyes going to be open? Are our ears going to be listening and our minds receptive and our hearts ready to take in these truths and more than take them in, to be willing to act upon them? We need to be able to listen Especially as we look to a new ministry, we need to be able to act and we need to be ready to do more together for the Lord Jesus. Fourthly, we have a final little section here, the healing of the blind man at Bethsaida. So when they arrive in the town of Bethsaida, some people brought a blind man to Jesus. In the Gospels, it's interesting that no two miracles of the blind receiving their sight are the same. Jesus deals with each one individually. The striking thing about this miracle is, to me, the two-stage process. Now, I managed to avoid the Sino-Phoenician woman who came, and Jesus seemed to dismiss her very quickly. I managed to duck that and get Gary to do it instead a few weeks ago. But we've got a bit of a conundrum here as well. Why is there a two-stage process in this miracle? Could Jesus not have cured the man instantly with a word? Why spit in his eyes and lay hands on them and then have to do the job again, lay hands on him again in order for him to receive his sight? Well, there's perhaps a couple of reasons for that. One is that the man was brought to Jesus. He wasn't like blind Bartimaeus saying, "Jesus, come have mercy on me," shouting out. He was brought by other people to Jesus, and perhaps he was doubting. Perhaps he didn't have much clue about who Jesus was, and he needed time with Jesus before he could really believe and receive his sight. But there's perhaps a further reason, and that's because of the position, again, that this miracle occupies in Mark's gospel. Mark is using this, and perhaps Jesus also was using this as an illustration, because Mark is the only one who records this miracle, and the position in Jesus' ministry is pivotal. It's at the end of the public ministry in Mark's gospel and the beginning of the shorter section where Jesus concentrates on teaching his disciples before they then head for Jerusalem. The disciples have been slow to believe and slow to understand, and slow to learn. Now, Jesus was willing and able to accommodate that, and thank God that he was and is. Because we're also slow to learn. We don't take things in right away, and we make mistakes, and we jump to the wrong conclusions. We cannot see beyond ourselves, and we fail to trust him. We all go around, and our spiritual eyes is like seeing people looking like trees around us. We don't see clearly. But Jesus is working in us and with us. And he touches us again, and if necessary, again and again, so that we might be able to see properly. So, remember the 3D glasses? Have you got your 3D glasses on? Are you ready to see what God is doing? Do you put them on every morning? How do you start your day? Do you start your day asking him for help? Asking him to help you to see what he is doing in your life and in the lives of others, and ready to take opportunities for him. We need to see things as Jesus does as we travel with him.